from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Human beings don't stand apart from natural ecosystems. We don't just hover above the planet's biosphere immune to the effects of its changes. Every change we impress upon nature comes back and changes us. Well, that may be the most important takeaway from the landmark UN report this week that declared humans are transforming nature at an unprecedented rate. Most major land habitats depleted, marine ecosystems utterly changed, 1 million plant and animal species threatened with extinction. Here's co-chair of the report, Eduardo Brondizio.
We're only starting to understand tipping points in Alaska, tipping points in the Amazon, tipping points in high mountains. So going to a question of a future where we continue as business as usual is a future full of uncertainty and risks.
And who might have to deal most intensely with that uncertainty and those risks? Well, us. As Robert Watson, chair of the UN panel, said, quote, "This report makes clear the links between biodiversity and nature and things like food security and clean water in both rich and poor countries." Well, this hour on Point, biodiversity, extinction, and human choices. You can join us. What's your reaction to the UN report? It is the largest assessment ever of planetary health. So what solutions do you see for saving plant and animal species, for biodiversity, and how we live around the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we'll also be taking a look at the deepening rift between Congress and the Trump administration. But first, let's talk in detail about this UN report on the health of planet Earth. Joining us from Durham, North Carolina, is Stuart Pym, professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. He's a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. He's testified before the House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. So, Stuart Pym, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much.
Also with us from Chicago, Illinois, is Andrew Wetzler, Managing Director of the Nature Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, a conservation group. He's worked for over 15 years in congressional administrative efforts to preserve species and strengthen the Endangered Species Act. So, Andrew Wetzler, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Stuart, first, let me start with you. Put this UN report in context. I mean, it is it looks over 15,000 studies heard from indigenous peoples around the world. It's 1,500 pages long. How significant is this assessment on the natural health of our planet?
I think the important thing about this report is that it's an international consensus. It's got science in it that isn't particularly new. Mm-hmm. It compiles results that we've known about for some time. But the fact that such a large group of people from around the world have come together and said, look, this is what we're doing. We're driving species to extinction 100 to 1,000 times faster than they would go extinct naturally. We're affecting both the land, the fresh water, and the marine environments in ways that are harmful to species. And finally, recognizing that nature does a lot for us. It protects our landscapes. It protects rivers. It protects the oceans. And we are harming those services that nature provides for us.
Well, Andrew Wetzler, same question to you. I mean, what sets this report apart from other reports, as Stuart points out, that we've had, for 25 years warning us about the threats to planetary biodiversity?
Well, it's certainly a more comprehensive report than we've seen in some time. And I agree that the fact that it's a consensus report and it is so alarming sets it apart. But more than that, I think that the time we're in sets it apart. I think there's been a real awakening of environmental consciousness. We saw the huge public reaction to the most recent UN report on climate a few months ago, and I think this is in a similar cultural place. I'm really hoping this is taken as a wake-up call and that we start to realize that if we don't start taking care of nature soon, nature's going to stop taking care of us.
Well, one of the other things that was very arresting about this particular report is that it underscores, Stuart, as you were saying, the speed at which these changes, these human-wrought changes, are happening. So I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Patricia Miloslavich. She's a marine biologist and contributor to this UN report. She told CBS News yesterday that the changes are happening so fast and so quickly in the natural world that we can actually see, in a sense, evolution, human-caused evolution, happening before our very eyes.
We are actually seeing evolution in our lifetime. People tend to think of evolution as a very long and slow process, which is true for many species, but we are also seeing evolution at very short rates because we're putting pressures on some of the species. Basically, we are not giving nature enough time to provide a response. So we will be out of the species in too short time for nature to give us something back.
That's marine biologist Patricia Miloslavic. Stuart Pym, I would like to ask you, I'm not doubting the veracity of this report, but looking over planetary history, right, people have said that we might be in the midst of the sixth mass extinction planet Earth has faced. So, I mean, in that case, is what distinguishes this one, that if indeed a mass extinction is going on, that it is it expressly caused by humankind? Can we say that for sure?
I think notions of the sixth extinction are simply grandstanding. They're an effort to engage the media, and I don't think they really help the discussion very much. What we know for certain is, as this report makes clear, we can calculate what fraction of species are going extinct from decade to decade. And we know that that rate is 100 to 1,000 times faster than the sort of the natural, the background rate of extinctions. We understand, importantly, why that's taking place. A big piece of that is land use change and changes to the ocean too and changes to the river. But if you look at what we're doing, we're destroying particularly tropical forests around the world. Something like two-thirds of all species live in tropical forests. And as we burn those forests, as we convert the wood into carbon dioxide, which then creates an enormous burden on the atmosphere and contributes to global warming, we're also destroying the homes where species live. And that is the major driver. We're careless about moving species around the planet. You know, we've introduced rabbits to Australia and cats to oceanic islands where species have no experience of them. And we're massively over-exploiting the oceans. The, comfort food in my youth was cod and chips. And coming out of Boston, you don't need to go to the grocery store to realize that we no longer have as much cod from our oceans than we used to do. We're mostly eating farm-raised fish. So there's a whole variety of changes that stem from destroying habitats, destroying rivers, destroying the land, destroying forests, destroying the oceans, and overexploiting the species that live there.
But let me ask you though, Stuart, the thing that was put in virtually every headline, in every news piece about this UN report yesterday was that potential loss of 1 million plant and animal species. Is that not a significant finding? Is that what you're saying?
I've chosen to frame it a little bit differently. The 1 million is a cute number. I think if you actually read the details of the report, you'd realize that it's probably substantially higher than that. What we do know is these rates. It's a death rate. It's rather like looking at human mortality. You know, we live in a society where, you know, one in 80 people die per year. And that's natural. If you lived in a place where one in eight people were dying per year, you'd be in a very dangerous part of the world. I think it's important for us to get the right kind of numbers. Because it's those numbers that we're going to have to reduce if we're going to solve this crisis.
Right. So, Andrew Wetzler, did you want to pick up on what Stuart's saying? Do you see it the same way?
I don't think I quite see it the same way. I actually think that talking about the sixth extinction, which a lot of scientists have done, highlighting the fact that it could be a million, or listening to Professor Pym, quite a bit more than a million species going extinct, and the absolutely underlying fact that I think we all agree to, that human beings are the cause, is the best way to grab the public imagination and talk about this in a way that's real and concrete. I mean, I live in the Midwest, and simply driving down the highway compared to 20 years ago and seeing the number of insects that hit your windshield, it's astonishingly different. And we need to convince people that this is, because it is, a sign of nature essentially collapsing around us, and to do something about it.
Well, I guess, and some of the numbers are quite stunning, right? I mean, the biomass of wild mammals falling by 82%? 82%, Andrew Wetzler?
Yes. I mean, some of these numbers are shocking. There's studies that show insect populations declining between 50 and 75% in different places around the world. Lion populations have dropped by nearly half in the last 20 years. There is really a very quiet but very significant unraveling that's going on.
So, Stuart Pym, let me circle back to something that you both noted at the beginning. The United Nations likes to operate on a consensus basis. So how significant is it that this report, with its, its very loud alarm bell feel, has been put forth by the UN? I mean, it means that we have consensus from nations around the world that there's a major problem that we have to deal with.
I think that's the strength of this report. It clearly covers and has representatives from a lot of different nations around the world. The extinction crisis is largely a crisis of developing countries, of tropical countries. It's clearly we have issues in the United States, but there are important issues in the tropics, and it's important we hear from those tropical countries.
Mm. Well, Stuart Pym and Andrew Wetzler, hang on here for just a second. We are talking about this massive UN report released this week that talks about the health and the threat to the health of biodiversity on planet Earth, and really how that rebounds back upon us, upon human beings. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about a landmark UN report that says human beings are transforming the natural world faster than ever, and what could come as a result of that is the possible extinction of a million plant and animal species and the overwhelming and perhaps irreversible change to natural systems around the world, and how that is going to have an impact upon us. So let's listen to the press conference, a little bit from the press conference in Paris yesterday, where the report was revealed. And here's the chair of the report, Robert Watson, who said that species extinction isn't simply an environmental issue.
It's an economic issue, a development, security, social, ethical, and moral issue. Biodiversity has incredible economic value.
Director General of the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, Audrey Azoulay, also said at that same press conference through an interpreter that protecting biodiversity is for the benefit of future generations.
Biodiversity loss has hit vulnerable populations particularly hard. This means that our global environmental heritage is being threatened. But on top of that, peace and security are also in peril. It is therefore incumbent upon us to take action for the benefit of future generations.
That's Audrey Azoulay, Director General of UNESCO. And some of the other facts or findings pulled out from this report: human beings now extract 60 billion tons of resources each year, almost double the amount that we were doing in 1980. Oceans are no longer a sanctuary. Only 3% of marine areas free from human pressure. Climate change, pollution, invasive species, population growth, and economic inequality also growing factors in the way and rate that humanity is transforming the planet. Let's go to our callers. Pat is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was wondering how much you all think that our own sense of survival, that we are constantly playing this game as if we have to survive, either takes away or contributes to our not being able to manage our resources properly.
Pat, thank you so much for your call. Stuart Pym, do you have a response for him?
I think, obviously, the issue is our greed, that we go out and we try to grab as much for ourselves as we can. And in the long run, that's not sustainable. We have to adopt strategies that take into account what we're going to leave for our children and our grandchildren. You know, when we destroy the world's fisheries, we eat fish, overexploit fish, that are not going to be there for our kids and grandkids. It's the same with the forests of the world. I think the issue of what some people call intergenerational equity is vital here. What sort of a planet are we going to leave for our children? And if we exploit it for ourselves just as hard as we can go, if our rich nations go after resources at the expense of poorer ones, you know, we're not going to have a planet for our kids and generations to come.
Well, Andrew Wetzler, though, is there optimism buried somewhere in this report? Because when we read that 83% of global wetlands have been depleted since the year 1700, and that 3% number I read earlier, of only 3% of the world's oceans are free from human interference, it sounds like that have we passed the point of no return for some of these ecosystems?
I don't think that we've passed the point of no return for global ecosystems. And just to turn Pat's question around a little bit, I'm hopeful that our sense of survival, because a lot of our survival is on the line, is actually going to propel us towards solutions. And the good news is we understand the problem. And from a technological point of view, we understand how to fix it. The solutions to these problems, protected areas, changing our agricultural practices, changing our forestry practices, reducing water pollution, they're not difficult. What's difficult is mustering the political will to put them into action. And I actually think this report is a good step toward doing that. And we're seeing a lot of international action that's moving in that direction, and everything from the Convention on Biological Diversity, ongoing UN negotiations over a high seas treaty, which will address that 3% figure you cited, and other more local practices around the world. And of course, the incredible role that indigenous peoples play in protecting their areas.
Indeed. Stuart Pym, let's all of us talk a little bit more about the direct relationship that the biodiversity loss has on us, on human societies, because I believe the report also talks about how, for example, when we talk about the depletion of plant species around the world, that losing that biodiversity has an impact on food systems, on agriculture directly. It's not just agriculture adversely impacting nature. It's that the loss can adversely impact our own food, Stuart. Tell us more about that.
Yes. I mean, we depend on biodiversity in many ways. And the poorer you are, the more likely you are to depend on it in a very immediate way. So, I mean, we go to the grocery store and our food comes from a whole variety of different places. You know, fish from all over the world, fruits and vegetables from all over the Americas and so on. Poor people depend on biodiversity in a very immediate way. If they chop a forest down on a hillside, it's likely to erode the next time it rains. So I think this report does an excellent job in making those connections to our well-being and what we call nature services or ecosystem services. We depend a lot on nature to provide us the variety of crops that we exploit. And, you know, having come back from the border of China and Myanmar last week, the contrast between China, that learned the hard way what happened when it chopped its forests down in the 1960s and then proceeded to reforest areas substantially, and the sort of enormous tragedy of what you see across the border in Myanmar, where they're still burning the forests, still suffering massive soil erosion, was really quite obvious.
Well, let's go back to our phones. Tom is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, my point is that back in the 70s, Paul Ehrlich with the population explosion bomb, you don't hear any more talk of that. And to me, that's a big part of what's going on. The other is the negative side effects of globalization. Cultures, indigenous cultures that used to live sustainably, have been replaced with people looking for ways to make money. And there's nature.
Yeah.
I think there's two points to the population story that Paul Ehrlich and Anne Ehrlich and others came out with. One of them is, you know, can we slow the human population growth down? And we are, and it's coming by and large from educating women. The better educated the woman is, the less likely she is to have a large family. So the rate of population growth is slowing. What is not always pointed out is that the other side of this is consumption. And, you know, it's not just a matter of stopping population growth. It's a matter of stopping our ever-increasing aspirations to having more and more and more of everything. And I think we have to tackle those things simultaneously.
Well, let's go now to Tim, who's calling from Elk Ridge, Maryland. Tim, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. The new report echoes the 2002 report that I was responsible for, delivering to 192 nations at the Global Summit for Sustainable Development. So we've known this for some time.
Well, Tim, hang on here for just a second. So since I only said your first name, since you just called in, is this Dr. Tim Forsman?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were the chief scientist for the UN Environment Program?
Yes, ma'am.
Ah, well, glad that you're listening to On Point. But now that we know who you are, please go ahead.
That's all right. My concern, as I said, is that this echoes the report from 2002 in the Global Environmental Outlook Report, which is our approximately 3 to 5 years that report comes out. And the grades are going down. And so as a 69-year-old, I can look at it with nostalgia. But if the children are the ones, and ones like Greta Thunberg up in Sweden, where she's making a stance as a 15-year-old for climate change, and this is biodiversity, which I've been saying for 18 years is just as big a deal as climate change. They have a new word, solastalgia, S-O-L-A-S-T-A-L-G-I-A, a new word that was coined in, I think, 2012, which talks about the psychological impact of this awareness. And that's what I'm concerned about children, because I write children's books, and we're trying to engage them with this reality, but you realize this cloud that we're holding over their heads with reports like this. And as you said, there's no good news in that report. We really need to talk about that. If you look at your children and tell them they're doomed, what do you think that's doing to their heads?
Yeah.
We really, really need to work on this. That's our number one issue, in my opinion.
Tim Forsman, though, hang on here for just a second, because I'm really glad that you called in. What do you think is preventing a more vigorous and cohesive global engagement with this problem? Because as you said, if the UN Environment Program put out a similar report years ago, and as both Stuart and Andrew have been saying today, this most recent report simply reiterates a lot of what we know. What's the primary thing that's stopping greater action?
Well, that is the $64,000 question, and John Holtz should be Holtz House should be asked that on Jeopardy. But the question resonates, because if you say, oh, it's greed and capitalism, well, I spent a lot of time with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and I've lived in Japan. And so you can't just look at our capitalism, but you can look at it as overpopulation, as Paul Ehrlich and others and the other gentleman mentioned. You can look at it as the consumption. But what I like to put positive is to focus with children, and I give talks to all kinds of children. My book, Last Little Polar Bear, and the new book called Satellites, which says, look, we have controls. We have levers that we can deal with. Now, a lot of them we can't control, and that's the big one about global countries and capitalism and or communism, you name the control, but the rules set on the international scene aren't working. Then there's the marketplace, and we're switching from plastic bags to paper bags. So that's positive, and you can control it. But the big control for 7.5 billion people is the daily choices we make.
Right.
What are we buying? What are we eating? Where do we live? How do we build our houses? That's the only control that these children can work with to begin looking at the next generations, because it is very dark and doomy, and I don't like to watch kids crying. So we try to get them excited about what they can do.
Well, Tim Forsman, former chief scientist for the UN Environment Program, calling us from Elkridge, Maryland. Thank you so much for calling. Andrew Wetzler, what do you think about what Dr. Forsman is saying there, that really, in a way, focusing on kids and helping them figure out better ways to make daily decisions for their generation, that's the big lever, as he called it?
Well, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and so I definitely identify with the stories that we tell them about the world they're going to inherit. And I am very inspired by the work of Greta and others. And I think what separates this report from the previous report in 2002 is the same thing that separates the UN climate change report that just came out from the similar reports from 2002 on climate change. It's the cultural moment, and it's the political moment that we're in. And we're seeing an explosion of interest in solving the climate crisis and solving the biodiversity crisis, in moving the world to a more sustainable place that I've never seen before in my career working on conservation. Mm-hmm. And that combined with the fact that we really do have the solutions at hand to fix this problem is what gives me hope. I personally think that what we need are systems changes. Changes to the way we grow food, changes to the way we produce energy, changes to the way that we trade in goods. That's very different than individual actions. Individual actions are important, but in the end, it's the systems that have to change if we're going to save the Earth.
Well, Stuart Pym, the problem with that, the primary challenge to what Andrew Wetzler is saying that I see is that human political systems are built around much shorter timescales, 2 years, 4 years, I mean, 10 years at the max or at the on the other end of the scale. So is there a fundamental disconnect between sort of our civil and societal systems that we've built that would affect this change versus the timescale in which the change has to happen?
I mean, I do think we have a problem with the political systems, which tend to view things in the short term. On the other hand, there are plenty of opportunities for the world's political leadership to come together and establish longer-term programs. I really disagree with the fact that this report is full of bad news. There's plenty of good news in this report. The most obvious thing is the extent to which we are now protecting very much more of the land surface and much more of the oceans than we were 25 years ago. The network of national parks and nature reserves around the world is expanding. It's now covering about 17% of the land surface. The meeting that will be held next year in Kunming in China, the Convention on Biological Diversity, is going to be setting new targets for nations to try and establish. And those are, you know, those are changes that go beyond, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 year political decisions. So I think if you look back over the last 25 years, we are making a lot of progress. We know a lot more about what we need to do, and we know how to implement those changes. And I think it's important to have a report like this that holds the statistics up to the world's politicians and say, look, we all agree on this, you know, let's start thinking about things that we can do together.
Well, Andrew Wetzler, we just have 30 seconds before we have to take a break. But when you hear Robert Watson saying that we're eroding the very foundations of economies, livelihoods, food security, health and quality of life worldwide, certainly that's impetus for even greater change or faster change along those very systems you were talking about.
I think that's absolutely right. And I do think that Stuart's correct, that there's a lot of good news in the report and that we are seeing the political systems start to react more quickly than we ever have before.
Well, Andrew Wetzler and Stuart Pym, one more break we have to take here, so hang on. We are talking about the UN's massive landmark report, the largest ever assessment of planetary biodiversity, how quickly it's dropping away and what impact that has on us, the 7 billion people on planet Earth who are really in control of the future. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the UN's massive report on the health of biodiversity on planet Earth and what we can do to reduce humanity's negative impact on natural systems, because, of course, those are the same natural systems that we all rely on. So let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Lynette, who's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. You're on the air, Lynette.
Hi, Meghna and guests. I became very upset about this, and so what I did was, when I bought this house, I have about one-third of an acre in Midtown, and I transformed it into a wildlife habitat. I took good care of my soil, so I have excellent earthworms, and I have excellent bees, and I have excellent frogs and lizards and so on, and it's been certified by the National Wildlife Federation. And if you look at a map of American gardens, which I did when I did a course in the Master Gardening Program, we have a lot of land. And if homeowners will convert their gardens into wildlife habitats, you know, it's not exactly a global scale, but it actually does help. And I have wildlife crowding to my garden.
Yeah. Well, Lynette, thank you so much for your call and for your efforts right there in your own garden. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking me. Hi, and I just wanted to chime in here. Your speakers have been looking for bright news, and the previous speaker, Annette, said she'd kind of restored her urban property to a wildlife habitat, and I just wanted to put in a word for the whole idea of ecological restoration generally. It has, in the past few decades, evolved into a very important part of it. Stuart Pym commented that 17% of the landmass of the planet is still in a semi-natural or natural condition, and we can grow that. It isn't just a one-way process, and we've shown here in the Midwest, for example, with pioneering work and the restoration of prairies, that we've got more prairies now than we had 50 years ago.
Right.
And I think that we can turn restoration not only into a technology, but a kind of a world renewal, kind of performing art, festivals based on prairie birds.
Yeah.
And save the planet.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for your call. Andrew Wetzler, let me turn back to you first on that. So Bill's saying there that we already have evidence that we can reclaim and restore some of these ecosystems. how much should we aim to restore? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, for years, E.O. Wilson has talked about half Earth, that we should really mm-hmm. set aside half the Earth to preserve as purely or as naturally as we can. And that's what we need. That's what we need to aim for in order to keep a healthy planet and therefore, you know, keep us as a species healthy as well.
Yeah, Bill and Lynette are absolutely right that restoration is going to be key to preserving the natural world. And it's really amazing how quickly and how robustly nature can come back if we just get our foot off its neck. Prairie restoration in the Midwest is a great example of that, as are local gardens going to native plants as opposed to pesticide-fed lawns. It's amazing how much wildlife populations will come back. And as for the larger point, we at NRDC believe that we need to protect at least 30% of land and water by 2030, including marine habitats, and endorse the long-term vision of half Earth. And that is going to take restoration, afforestation, planting forests where they don't exist right now, restoring wetlands, restoring prairies. And again, the good news is that is doable. We know how to do it, and it generally works.
By 2030? Yes, that seems...
No, not by 2030. Okay. 30 by 30.
30 by 20, but still, it's only 11 years away. But yeah. Stuart Pym, go ahead.
Yeah, if that's the bill, I think it is. He's been a leader in pushing ecological restoration and a real inspiration. I run a small nonprofit called Saving Species. We help countries, NGOs around the world in biologically rich places to restore land, to raise money to help them buy land, to restore the connections between habitats. We've not only destroyed habitats, but a lot of what we've left behind is in fragments. Very cheaply, we can reconnect those fragments. Restoration is a strong possibility, and it empowers people. It tells people, as one of the listeners pointed out, that we can claw back. We can convert damaged land into biologically rich areas. And I think that's not only an important and effective, but spiritually renewing, because it shows we don't have to accept all the bad things that are happening.
Well, I must get one more call in here. I want to go to Judith, who's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Judith, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. I wanted to mention that I think we're ignoring the elephant in the room, really, because there are just so many vested interests of all the corporate and political elite who are just totally focused on profit above all else. We only have to look at this in a current administration with changing the Clean Water Air, the Clean Water and Air Acts, and the drilling and everything else. And they're just it's just so frustrating because there's so many incredible things that people are doing. Yet if we could just change that mindset to moving to the greater good of all rather than their vested interest into their pockets and their investors, I think it would totally help turn things around.
Well, Judith, thank you for your call. Stuart Pym, we have about 30 seconds remaining in this conversation, but how would you like to respond to her?
I think this report has ammunition for that. It shows that nature is valuable. It does very important things for us. And those who want to trash our national parks need to be told that those national parks are really important for local economic interests. Biodiversity matters for us, both as an ethical issue, but importantly as an economic issue.
Well, Stuart Pym, professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, speaking to us from Durham, North Carolina. Professor Pym, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Andrew Wetzler, Managing Director of the Nature Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, joining us from Chicago. Chicago, Andrew Wetzler, it's been a pleasure to have you as well.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, we have to take a step back here for a second, and when we come back, we'll talk about executive privilege and the Mueller report. This is On Point. Attorney General William Barr's deadline to submit the full Mueller report to Congress came and went on Monday. So the staff of House Judiciary Chairman Democrat Jerry Nadler meets today with the Justice Department to try to resolve the dispute. And for now, a vote to hold Barr in contempt of Congress is scheduled for tomorrow. So one of the many questions hovering over Washington right now is, what role does executive privilege play, or could it play, in resolving this dispute between the Trump administration and Congress? And joining us now from Washington is Olivia Beavers, congressional reporter for The Hill. Olivia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And also with us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University. Ross, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So, Olivia, first of all, let me ask you, what do we think might happen, or is there any optimism in terms of something happening with this meeting between Nadler's staff and the Justice Department today?
Look, right now it looks like it's probably going to be routine. I was asking lawmakers last night whether they had any hope that they would reach an agreement, and a lot of them just deferred to the Chairman Nadler and whether he would agree. Now, Chairman Nadler has said he is going to fight tooth and nail to see all of these redacted pieces of the report, which includes grand jury material and other sensitive information. And that's the exact information that Barr says he is not going to give to Congress. So right now, both sides have just been very stubborn and neither side have let up. So the contempt, the move to hold him in contempt looks like, at least right now, like it will just be something that Democrats will vote for and usually probably along party lines. So,
well,
at least tomorrow.
Yeah, so that is likely to come tomorrow, as you just said. But remind us here, because the speed of the news moves so quickly these days. Just remind us, what was the argument that Bill Barr was making last week when he testified before the Senate about why he wouldn't give a fully unredacted version of the report to Congress?
So Bill Barr says he gave as much information as he could, but he was following special counsel regulations that were established after the Whitewater investigation in the Clinton administration. So he was following within the guidelines, and he could go to court and request that this information eventually be released to Congress, but that's something he said he wouldn't do. And Democrats say that in every other past special counsel investigation, they would be able to have that information and they want it now. But it's really unclear. It looks like if the fight is over grand jury material, it will just end up being a protracted court battle.
Okay. Well, Ross Baker, let me turn back to you because, you know, Olivia walked us through sort of where we are now regarding the specifics of those redacted portions of the Mueller report. But more broadly, the president said, what was it? Was it last week that he may decide soon whether or not to exert executive privilege over some of the subpoenas and the former white members of the White House who have been called to testify. Why is that significant?
Well, you know, executive privilege, Meghna, is a contested term. The term was first mentioned back in the 1950s when Senator Joseph McCarthy demanded documents from President Eisenhower. And Eisenhower, with the advice of his attorney general, mentioned that there was this thing called executive privilege. And many legal scholars don't even believe it exists. It's just an assertion that presidents make to avoid disclosing information which may be embarrassing to them. So, but what we're seeing now in the conversations between Congressman Nadler, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and the Justice Department is very typical of these situations. Very often what goes on in public, there's a lot of posturing that goes on, but basically both sides are trying to get this thing settled before it gets into the courts. Congress really doesn't want to have their investigatory powers redefined by the Supreme Court, and the president doesn't want the whole notion of executive privilege to be thrown out as a kind of legal fiction.
But just to be clear, though, if I remember correctly, last month Bill Barr said he didn't use executive privilege when first redacting the Mueller report. As Olivia said, he was just looking to rules in the special counsel's in the special counsel law.
That's right. Olivia's quite correct. No, Barr himself did not do it. The person mentioning executive privilege is the president, not surprisingly.
Well, and specifically, I think the president said he may exert executive privilege in preventing Don McGahn, former White House counsel, from testifying before Congress. Has executive privilege been used that way to block people from testifying who have been subpoenaed?
Yes, even people who are no longer with the government. This happened with Harriet Myers, who worked for President George W. Bush. She had already left the White House. And she was, again, this was by John Conyers, chairman of the Judiciary Committee at that time in the House, who wanted to have her testify. And President Bush exerted executive privilege to try to prevent this private citizen, as Don McGahn is, from testifying.
Okay, so Olivia Beavers, what do you think about that?
And I did want to add to that point. So Democrats are saying that the president cannot assert executive privilege on these former administration officials like Don McGahn because he already waived that right when he spoke to the special counsel. So they're saying because he didn't do it for McGahn then, they can't do it for him now. Now, a White House lawyer has argued against that, saying that these were special circumstances, basically. But what you're going to see is Democrats saying, no, you can't do that. You need to talk to us. And they're showing that they're going to be issuing subpoenas. And, you know, I haven't heard Nadler speak about holding McGahn in contempt, but that's something that he might move to do if McGahn refuses to comply.
Interesting. Well, Ross Baker, though, I mean, it seems to me that administrations coming from both sides of the aisle, whether the Republican or Democrat, once they're in the White House, they believe in the exertion or the power of executive privilege. I mean, isn't the fundamental argument that if a president can't use executive privilege on occasion to protect the functioning of the office of the presidency, that would make it impossible to securely do the job?
Well, that's the argument, of course, that President Nixon's lawyers made back in 1973. They said that making a president respond to court orders would, and I quote, would effectively destroy the status of the executive branch and an equal coordinate element of government. If he had to, it would simply be impossible for any president of the United States to function, which is clearly a very dramatic assertion, but a huge exaggeration. And yes, actually, executive privilege has become kind of an ecumenical belief among presidents of both parties and of all ideologies.
And so how might this be resolved? I mean, is it inevitably going to end up in the courts?
Well, I think it certainly could be, and some of these have. I mean, there have been actually, in the case of Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten, who were two White House officials under George W. Bush, there was actually a civil suit filed by the Judiciary Committee that did end up in court. And Congress won, and I think that both sides, of course, I think are leery of getting into the court system because they're afraid of what the result might be.
Right. Well, Olivia Beavers, getting back to this question of the contempt charge with Bill Barr, we were talking earlier this week about how Attorney General Eric Holder was held in contempt of Congress in the Obama administration. And following that vote, ultimately, there was some sort of resolution regarding documents that the Obama White House had that Congress wanted about the Fast and Furious program. So is a resolution, I mean, ultimately, it might take a lot of work, but a resolution could happen with even after a contempt vote.
That's true. Although if you talk to Trey Gowdy and some of the other Republicans who are trying to get information about Fast and Furious, they will say that they still are waiting on the documents that they wanted for that. So it's not going to be fully resolved if they're waiting for everything that they want. But in that case, they did get more information. They moved to hold Holder in contempt, but the DOJ did not enforce it. So that's what happens when you have a difference in Congress, a different party in power in Congress, and a different party in power in the White House.
Oh, step by step, day by day. Olivia Beavers, congressional reporter for The Hill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University, thank you as well.
Thank you, Megna.
I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.